Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 419 of the podcast. And I hope you all enjoyed the extra in-between-isode this week, which only just went out as I'm recording this, so there's no comments or anything as yet. But I did enjoy talking about that. So today I'm talking to Caroline Donahue from the Secret Library podcast, which maybe some of you listen to, about how we can use the symbolism of tarot to inspire our writing, deepen our characters and discover more about ourselves. And we both love Jungian psychology. And of course, you've heard me talk about the shadow many times, but we also talk about different archetypes in this interview. So that is coming up. In publishing news this week, the big kerfuffle is all about plagiarism and ghostwriting in the romance community in particular. I'm sure the practice is wider than that, but the romance landia, as I've seen it called on Twitter, which I think is a brilliant word. So essentially, and I'll link to Courtney Milan's blog post, which kind of kicked this off. Essentially, a Brazilian romance author hired ghostwriters to write romance books, providing them with both outlines, but also, it seems, and this is allegedly, I suppose, because I'm just taking this information from blog posts, but essentially, there were chunks of scenes taken straight out of best-selling romance author books. And there's lots of proof of the chunks of the scenes on various blog posts. So Courtney Milan was definitely plagiarized, Bella Andre, and a number of other really top best-selling romance authors. And some of the books by this particular author contain chunks from multiple other books. So it's actually quite a complex case of plagiarism, I think, as in, you'd have to work really hard to do this, because it's not just here, take someone's book and change a few things. It's taking lots of different books and putting them all together and changing a few things. But so the discussion has been moving and shifting this week. And you can find a lot of the stuff on Twitter at #copypastechris and Chris spelled C-R-I-S. And I'll link to all this in the show notes. But it started out as the author saying that it was the ghostwriter's fault. But of course, as we know, if you use a ghostwriter, if you're publishing the work, you are saying that you own the copyright. And also there should be, in the contract, there should be a sort of warranty that says the work is original and is not plagiarized. Then it sort of emerged that actually the author provided these chunks and the ghostwriters didn't do it. Plus, if you're getting your ghostwriters on Fiverr for very cheap money, I don't know what you'd expect. So I wanted to talk about this. And Christine Catherine Rush, who of course has so much experience in the writing community and has written a fantastic blog post about this too, very wide ranging blog post about the practice of using ghostwriters and also her thoughts on it. So I'll link to that. That's also chriswrites.com, and that's Chris, K-R-I-S, or K-R-I-S-writes.com. I'll link to that too. So my thoughts, first of all, really important that we don't have a go at ghostwriters, because I'm sure many of you listening are ghostwriters. There are lots of people who use ghostwriting as a way to earn money from their writing. And ghostwriting is a normal accepted practice in traditional publishing, has been for a long, long time. It is huge in a nonfiction. Let's face it, if you see a book with a famous name on the cover, it is probably ghostwritten. Because the publishers are often using those people's platforms to sell more books. And, you know, why would they write it themselves? Some of them do, obviously, but most work with ghostwriters. So very common in nonfiction, but also happens a lot in fiction, probably far more often than you might think. quite often with big name authors who can't necessarily fulfill contracts on time. I've heard stuff about that. Found a Readsy blog post about, and I'll link to this, that H.P. Lovecraft, horror supremo, ghost wrote a story for Harry Houdini called Imprisoned with the Pharaohs, which is fantastic. And those of us who are my age, probably in your 30s, 40s, 50s, remember Nancy Drew. And Carolyn Keene, who wrote the Nancy Drew books, was not one writer. There were lots of ghost writers who wrote the Nancy Drew books. So that's just, a couple of examples. Then there are the lots of people like Robert Ludlum, who died sort of 18 years ago, is still putting out books, and some have another name on the cover, some don't. So ghostwriting is not the issue here. There are, and in fact, on this show, we've had the lovely Roz Morris, one of the most popular guests on the show. Roz writes literary fiction under her own name, but in the past, she also does editing. She writes lots of craft books, the Nail the Novel series. But Roz used to ghostwrite best-selling thrillers under a very well-known name, which is Secret, because she was a ghost. And this is the point. A contract with a ghostwriter basically says that the ghostwriter is writing something original, and then the name on the cover is the person who is, you know, the author representing whoever they're writing under. And again, this is very common. So I saw quite a lot of people on Twitter really misunderstanding what ghostwriting is. It is work for hire, basically. Some people were saying, oh, the person who writes the book should have their name on the cover. But that does not apply when it comes to ghostwriting, because they've written the book and then they've given it to the publisher or the author or whoever, and that author gets their name on the cover. Whatever you feel about that in terms of should people be able to pay for work, well, tough luck. This happens, and there's absolutely no reason why that shouldn't happen in an ethical manner, so that writers can earn money and other writers can put books out with their names on. So I don't have a problem with that. Some people are also confusing it with co-writing. So I've co-written a number of books, 7 books, I think, at this point. So The Healthy Writer with Dr. Ewan Lawson, for example, or Risen Gods with Jay Thorne. Both of those books, that's a fiction and a non-fiction, have both of our names on the cover. We didn't use a ghostwriter. We all wrote our chapters and we put them together. Now, Penny Appleton, which I co-wrote with my mum, is slightly different because my mum wrote the first draft and then I edited it. But because it was such a substantial edit, it was more like a co-writing project. But we also used a third pen name, Penny Appleton, for those books, because my mum didn't want to use her real name, and I don't write sweet romance, certainly don't write it anymore. So that was a kind of a short-term project. But co-writing is completely different to ghostwriting, and don't want those to be confused. Also, with co-writing, you would generally share the costs. So you'd share the editing costs, the cover design costs, and then you share in the royalties and the promotion. So whereas with ghostwriting, you pay the ghost for work for hire, you get the manuscript and they disappear and you do what you want. And if you can make more money, then you get to keep the money. So that's the difference between ghostwriting and co-writing. The next thing is plagiarism. And this is so important, because I feel like in the excitement of gossip, I mean, it has turned into gossip, a lot of this, but there is some very clear legal stuff going on, and it's important to understand. Plagiarism is not something that an ethical ghostwriter would be doing. Ghostwriters would write their own book. They don't need to plagiarize. They're professional writers. Plagiarism is copying someone else's work and passing it off as your own. And of course, this is stealing. This is against the terms of copyright. This is legally and ethically wrong. And I, of course, know that none of you guys listening would ever do this, but I just wanted to check that everyone understood hiring a ghostwriter is not plagiarism. And when I was just looking at the stuff on Twitter, I just felt that things needed to be nailed down a bit more. So the next thing that is probably more interesting from our perspective is, why are indies using ghostwriters? And Christine Catherine Rush tackles this in her blog post, which is, how come this is becoming so massive in the indie community. And it, of course, it comes down to the rapid release model, which is not something I've ever done. But I, of course, know authors who do the rapid release and who do write their own books. But I also know of many groups of authors who publish under one name with rapid release, or who do use ghostwriters, and or who kind of co-write but also buy work for hire, this type of thing. So because the algorithms favour fast production, rapid release, some authors putting out, you know, one book a month, two books a month, and as I've mentioned before, even a book a day for those models where there's multiple authors writing in under one name. Because if you think about it, if 30 authors write one book a month, you've got a book a day. And then if we add on the stuff I talked about last week with OpenAI and the fact that very soon, I mean, already they can generate text. So, you know, what would happen if I fed... I fed the whole works of Stephen King into this AI, trained it on Stephen King, and then had it generate work for me. You know, is that plagiarism? What is that? So these are some of the questions we're going to have to tackle. I do believe we have to look at this type of thing, but essentially for us in the community, we need to be very clear about what is ethical and what is acceptable. And this is the KU page read model. It's encouraging bad behaviour. And I know many of you are in KU and do not indulge in bad behaviour. So it's certainly not an indictment on that, on authors behaving ethically. But in a environment where you can get quick money very fast through scamming, the scamming's never going to go away. So what I think is very important is it's very good to understand all of this, but you don't need to get depressed. I've seen a lot of people going, well, what's the point in writing? You know, if why am I slaving over all this stuff when someone else is just plagiarizing and making money and doing this, that and the other? But the point is, that is not why we do this. To me, all of that stuff. So why I have never hired a ghostwriter, and I mean, I don't know, I'm not never going to say never, but for me, the whole point is doing the writing. You know, I'm struggling through the first 20 to 30,000 words of my next novel right now. And for me, the creative struggle is the point. It's discovering who we are. It's discovering what is going on inside ourselves that comes out onto the page. It's not the finished product. Of course, the finished product is important for making a living with our writing, but to me, the whole point is the creativity. And I measure my life by what I create in the world that is new. And that's another thing. Where is the satisfaction in creating something new that only you could create if you're hiring someone to write it? I don't get that. I really don't. But and also, to be fair, I'm sure there's easier ways of making money. But back on why you shouldn't get depressed or even worried about this. There will be more content. There will be more scammers. There will be more people doing KU naughty things. You know, there will be changes in how we market. None of this is new. Really, people have always done this stuff. But what it comes down to is writing the books you love, attracting readers who become loyal to you. And this is, again, I'm in my in-between episode that came out, which is talking about voice, my actual voice, as well as my voice on the page. And Christine Catherine Rush talks about readers becoming dedicated to an author because of their voice. And a ghostwritten book will never have the same voice as one written by the author. Of course, if you get all your books ghostwritten, you won't have a voice. but it's, you know, I do also trust and believe that people will always want to support the creators they love. And you need to foster that connection over time. Instead of going, oh, I must get more page reads by going on the rapid release model, even if it's not your way of working, certainly not mine, then maybe think about how else you can foster a relationship with a reader. So my choice, as I've talked about before, with content marketing is building my new site, soon to be announced, doing another podcast, narrating my own books. So my voice is in the head of the listener, and also continuing to write the books I love over time so that I can be proud of my body of work and also make multiple streams of income. Because I think this is another problem. The crux of the issue is that some of these authors are dependent on Amazon KU page reads. And if you become dependent on one income stream, that is going to be a problem because you're going to do anything to keep that going. Whereas I've talked about before, I have so many income streams now, some of them very, very small, some of them like $10 a month, but I have so many of them that all of those things mean I'm not dependent on one vendor. I also have seen in the lots of the comments that the author is Brazilian and had heard that you can make a lot of money on Amazon in the US, kind of a gold rush mentality around, this model. And that is, and I've also seen some comments from traditionally published authors saying that this is just the latest in the bad behavior of self-publishing is bad. And that's the thing that annoys me the most, I think. It's tarring us with the same brush. And of course, we are not that. So I've always said you can make a good living from your writing, which you can, as evidenced by lots of us doing this in an ethical manner. But I still haven't made a million from my book sales in total over 10 years, let alone in a year. But hey, I'll get there eventually. But through writing my own books. So in conclusion, stick with ethical long-term business practices. Write the books you love. If you do use a ghostwriter, and again, there's nothing wrong with choosing to use a ghostwriter if that's what you want to do, but pay them well. Pay them well enough that they can write a book that is not plagiarized. Also, don't plagiarize anyone, and build relationships with readers over time. And yeah, love what you do and measure your life by what you create. Right, rant over. So my personal update this week, as I mentioned, I'm still working on the first draft of Map Walker Book 2, and my working title is Map of Plagues. I'm still kind of coming down on the title. I have started my Pinterest board, which I really love. So as I write, I have a Pinterest board, which you can find jfpen.com/jfpen, something like that. And I put images there as I do my research, and I did some dictation this week. I'm just for accountability, I'm at around 16,000 words with a lot of notes. I'm doing a lot of reading. I am a very messy first draft writer and I write all over the place. I don't write in order. It's quite fun. It is fun. It's exciting. But I also have these huge bouts of self-doubt. It's this massive roller coaster of creativity. But as I just said, this is how I discover. I am a discovery writer. I love kind of feeling out where things are going. I do know my themes. I understand my themes. This whole series is about borders. It's very much the first book, Map of Shadows, came out of my anger at Brexit. But of course, it's nothing to do with Brexit. This is what's fun with fiction, right? You can have a theme that you're angry about and then write a book that has nothing to do with that topic, and yet underneath that theme resonates. So the theme of borders and refugees and where you belong and home and that type of thing, that's what these books are about, but they're more dark fantasy adventure type books too. So I'm having a good time, but I am in a mess. It is messy at the moment, and that's fine. Creativity is messy. I'm not very linear in my creative process. I am also doing publishing-y things. So the Dark Queen audio short story is loaded up to ACX and Find Your Way Voices. So that is coming soon. Also doing it as a paperback. You only need, I think, 26 or 28 pages to do a paperback. So that's what it is. It's very short. But it's worth it to me for the comparison pricing, having a print book and as well as an audio and an ebook. And of course, with print on demand, and if you have Vellum, for example, this stuff doesn't cost you much money. And what else? I'm going through all my audio still, loading up anything onto Findaway I can. And hopefully soon I'll be promoting the Authors Direct thing a bit more. So because, you know, we've got ways of selling ebooks direct that are easy, but Authors Direct for audio is great because it actually has an app, so the quality is better. I've sold MP3s for years, nearly 9 years now I've been selling MP3 downloads, but this is an app that makes the audiobook process, the audiobook listening experience better, because otherwise you used to have to buy MP3s from me, download them to your computer, upload them to your device or your phone, and then listen like that. So that's very cool. And if you do go through Findaway Voices, you can publish on your Authors Direct platform. So thanks for all your emails and tweets this week. Lots of enthusiasm about the show with Will from Findaway Voices last week. A couple of things. Judy says, I love getting behind the wheel and listening to your podcasts. Before I know it, my 2-hour commute between magical Mungo Eyes, Coastal Harmony and downtown Auckland's madness has flown by. Maria says, thanks for this informative podcast. It's come at the right time as I'm contemplating producing an audio book. I'm fascinated by the launch all formats together strategy, which I might try next year. And then a few tweets. Brittany Fixer says, listening to the podcast while enjoying the Las Vegas snow with some beautiful pictures. Yeah, snow. I think it's the first snow since 1947 or something in Las Vegas, which is, yes, there we go. Climate change. Christopher Peterson says, this was so good. Brilliant podcast with a ton of useful and relevant information about producing audiobooks and the future of audiobooks. Great podcast atmosphere too. Yeah, I definitely get on well with Will. We're going to hang out at London Book Fair as well soon. And it's always good to geek out with people who you get with your interests. That's me and Will. Wynne Kelly Charles says, thank you for a fabulous podcast. I'm going to be using all the services you guys talked about for my next book. Brilliant. And finally, Tommy Carbone says, I like the idea from the end of the show, AI of celebrity voices. Now I need to write one where I can incorporate the creative pen's bubbly laugh for a character. Okay, so just to be clear, I will be happy to license my voice out, but you will have to pay a license fee. Absolutely. But no, I'm looking forward to that too. Hence why I'm growing my voice brand. Right. And just one comment from Claire Sager, who I thought this was great. Podcast happiness is sitting at the bus stop trying not to cheer when the creative pen says she's making time to work on the shadow book. Thank you, Claire. And I've been talking about this for so many years now, I really have to get into it. But as I've mentioned before, it's a deep and meaningful one, although it is relevant for this podcast today because, of course, Jungian psychology is probably where the first idea for this came from for me back when I was about 21, when I was studying Jung at university. Right, so today's show is sponsored by my own courses. Yes, I have multiple streams of income, and one of which is teaching courses. And I have a new course on productivity for authors, which I thought I'd mention because it is about writing more and achieving your creative goals. But surprisingly, it does not mention ghostwriters or plagiarism. However, it does have lessons on saying no and setting boundaries, finding time to write, making the most of your writing time, co-writing. Yes, I talk about co-writing. Also working with author assistants and outsourcing, dictation and tools that I use, and also thoughts on health and mindset. And I have personally turned a corner around productivity in the last 6 months, especially around saying no, which I've got a lot better on. So you can find all my courses. So productivity for authors, content marketing for fiction, how to write a novel, how to write nonfiction, and more at thecreativepen.com/learn, LEARN. Right, so this type of sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing, but my time in creating the show is sponsored by my patrons. So thank you to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. I say this every week, but it means so much to me that you enjoy the show enough to throw in a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month for those generous people. Thanks to new patrons this week, Rebecca Jackson, Renee Gallant, I.B. Miller, Jeanette Jensen, and Christopher Mitchell. I really do appreciate your support on Patreon. Like the tweets and emails, it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And of course, if you do support the show on Patreon, you get an extra audio every month, 40, 45 minutes of Q&A. And I pick questions from, I don't pick them, I just answer them in order, questions from patrons every month. And occasionally I do little extras as well. So you can support the show at patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Today, I'm here with Caroline Donahue. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, it's so nice to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Caroline is an American author and writing coach living in Berlin, Germany. She's also the host of the Secret Library podcast, which is fantastic. And I've been on it, so go listen
to that.
You've
been on it twice.
Yeah, I know, it's amazing. And anyway, today we are talking about her latest book, Story Arcana, Using Tarot for Writing, which is super cool and something I have definitely done over my creative lifetime. So Caroline, just start by telling us a bit more about you and how you got into writing.
I think it's one of those things where it's difficult to say when it started, because it was kind of always there. I think I have these memories of being a little kid and taking stacks of paper and folding them in half and stapling them and making books like at a compulsive pitch. And then the problem was that I would write a few pages in there that would just, I mean, I may have been early kind of compulsive bookbinder as much as anything else, at which point my mother pointed out, you know, you might actually want to write in them before you make another one. But I was the kid who was hiding under, you know, the piano in the corner of the classroom and reading. And I pulled my first all-nighter, I think, when I was in third or fourth grade, reading Bridge to Terabithia. Like, it started very early, the obsession with books. And my mother used to say that I ate books, which I think is fairly accurate. I'd rather give up food than books, probably. And so there was always, with this intensity about books, there was always an interest in writing. And I was fortunate in that my family was not the kind of family that said, oh, that's a terrible idea, you'll starve to death and die, or the things that people say. And I got to go to some creative writing camps. There were some, you know, writing classes early on in school. And I was really supported in that enjoyment. Now, the funny thing is that I didn't end up getting a degree in creative writing at school. I studied art history, and then I ended up studying psychology, which has actually been a better degree for writing in some ways, because just getting into the way people work and the way that they think has continued to engage me. And I think as a person, that people have called us scanners or multi-passionate or, you know, many, many interests. And I find that actually being into books is the best possible way to handle this, because every book can be different. As you know, you can write fiction and nonfiction. And writing has been a way for me to stay engaged with many different interests and yet appear to have a cohesive career. So
I think
it's really worked in the long term.
I totally get that. And I think that works really well. I feel the same way. Like, we can do our research however we like. I mean, I have a second degree in psychology, and also art history comes into a lot of my books as well. So obviously you and I have a lot in common. We always talk about this. Totally. Yeah. So let's get into the tarot, because I feel like the tarot has a lot of, in fact, I blame Hollywood. I blame, you know, media for making it sort of only gypsy fortune tellers or, you know, satanic rituals use tarot cards. So give us, you know, tell us a bit more about what tarot is and some of the misconceptions that there might be out there.
Well, one of my favorite sort of debunking statements about the whole kind of, is it a satanic tool? Is a friend of mine, Susanna Conway, always says, well, they're just bits of cardboard with pictures on them. Like, that's what they are. And I think about, you know, there are a lot of tools out there that are used for communication and exploration. And I think people thought the telephone was kind of a satanic tool early on because it appeared to, you know, it allowed people to communicate over long distances in ways they wouldn't normally be able to do. So I think the tool itself is actually quite neutral. And I think that it depends on how you use it. Some people use it and claim to use it to be able to predict the future. And that's not how I'm working with it. And it's not how most of the people I've studied with, I don't think I've actually ever studied with anyone who claims to be able to predict the future. It's more that from my background where I studied expressive arts therapy and psychology is the relationship that the unconscious mind has to imagery. Mm-hmm. And the mind abhors a vacuum. So if you present a brain with a picture that looks like there's something going on in the picture, and then you try to say to yourself, okay, well, what's going on here? Your mind will start to fill in the gaps. It just happens naturally. We are storytelling, meaning-making beings. It's sort of how we've made sense out of our lives as long as people have existed. So they're basically, the tarot is a system that's been around for hundreds of years. It was originally started as, there are mixed kind of thoughts on it, but the sort of greater consensus is that it was started as a card game and that some fortune tellers kind of co-opted the card game and then started to use it for fortune telling. So it wasn't even intended as a fortune telling tool from the beginning, but because it's had this long association, a lot of people get nervous and freaked out about that. And there are some relatively scary pictures on it. You know, people get scared of the devil card, or they get scared of the tower, or they get scared of death, you know, these kinds of, they're not light topics, but I think that, I mean, life isn't light either. If we look at it below the surface, it's not like life is puppies and kittens and flowers everywhere, and we never have to deal with anything dark. In many ways, I feel like the tarot is a more honest representation of our experience as people because it does include dark imagery. And good books include dark stuff. They're not just sort of la, 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 everything's beautiful, the end. I mean, we might want to write one of those sometimes because it would be kind of a relief, but I don't write those. And
Neither do I.
Of the people I read, no, you definitely do not. And most of the people that I know who read books don't want to read those either.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's something on that deeper level. Oh, you just reminded me there of James Bond, Live and Let Die. I think that the hanged man and the kind of, you know, the sort of voodoo stuff coming up from the grave, and it's been associated with stuff like that. But actually, as you say, I love that. Just pictures on pieces of cardboard. That's fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, bless you, Susanna, for that one. But it's true. They are a neutral, they're an inanimate object. You know, there is no power inside of them that's going to change or control your life. It's a way for you to trick your unconscious to giving you information that's not readily available.
No, it's like almost like a writing prompt, I guess, when we're talking about writers. So just talk a bit more, I guess. So the symbolism of tarot. So maybe just pick a card, any card, and talk a bit about how the symbolism of a card might help us access that unconscious mind.
Well, I think that the one that I've focused on, because there are 72 cards in the deck, and I have only focused on the first 22 in this book, because I feel like they're a set. The major arcana is traditionally looked at as a set. And for those who don't know much about tarot, there's the major arcana and there's the minor arcana. And the majors have, in all decks, they have big pictures on them and they have big names and they are big types like the Hermit or the, you know, the Fool or the Magician. Anyone who's seen Googled tarot sees that yellow picture from the Rider-Waite with the guy with his arms outstretched and the symbols around him. That's sort of a standard image. So that's the major arcana, and they represent major, you know, major turns in the road, big changes. And the minors are more everyday incidents. And then within that, there are the court cards, which are people. And so I'm planning to write about those later in terms of plot. And the court cards, I think, are more about character development. Mm. So I'm going to play with those later. So in terms of a you know, pulling cards in order to work with them in a story. Sometimes what you'll see is that, I don't know if anyone has this issue. I have this issue sometimes when writing a character, it feels a bit forced, or it feels like I'm kind of the character's mouthing what I want them to say, or they feel a bit like a puppet. And there has to be some kind of unconscious motivation going on, maybe that the character isn't even aware of, because we do things all the time, not realizing why we're really doing them. And you want your characters to feel more like real people. So sometimes asking a question like, well, what are they hiding here? What are they maybe hiding from themselves? And then pulling a card and seeing what comes out, you can kind of, then you can start to turn it into a puzzle. So say you have a character who's a really, really friendly, helpful, you know, kind-hearted character. And then you pull a card and the card underneath that's hiding from them is something like, I'm not going to be too crazy, like the devil, but if they had something like, the Hierophant hiding underneath. And the Hierophant is about institutions of thought. It's also about this sort of institutionalized religion, organized thinking, society, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So you might have a character who appears to be extremely helpful, but if you look at their underneath agenda, they're really trying to push a system. They might be trying to convert somebody. They might be trying to put them in a box or have them make sense. So it's a way to make a dynamic just a little bit more sophisticated. And often it doesn't take that much to make a scene just a little bit more interesting, or a dialogue just a little bit more realistic. Because, you know, if you have a scene that's like, hi, John, I've just been to the store. They were out of milk. And he says, well, damn, I'm really sad that they were out of milk. Well, that's not going to be that interesting. But if what's really happening is it's, you know, a man and woman, and he thinks she hasn't really been to the store. He thinks she's been sneaking out to see her lover. You know, if you find that underneath, if you pull the levers and see, ooh, maybe somebody thinks there's something else going on, then the thing about the milk can be pretty dynamic.
Mm. So I love that. And it's really interesting. And I told you this earlier, but at several points in my life journey, I've pulled the moon and the hermit. And amazing, the moon especially has come up for me again and again. And I haven't done my own spread that often in my life, but at major points where I've gone, I just don't know what I'm doing with my life, I pulled the moon. So just in case anyone's interested, what do you think that says about me?
Well, I mean, those are like the most beautiful introvert cards for the first reaction for those two. But I think the moon is about intuition, and it's about, you know, the moon comes out at night, and it's illumination that happens at night. And it's also on many decks, if you're looking, I think you said you had a Rider-Waite, but if you look at a Rider-Waite moon, you'll see this crazy lobster crawling out of the water. There's a lot of weird stuff going on in the moon. There's like a wolf howling, and there's usually this lobster coming out. And so I think that the moon to me represents looking at the unconscious and seeing what comes up from the depths, if you really pay attention to that. So if you're working with the moon, it's not all going to be out in the open. It's not like, say, the sun, another card, where everything will be really obvious up front. Everything's good. It's easy. But the moon is like, you have to stay, you have to wait until it gets dark out, you have to wait until some light comes out, and then the stuff's going to start coming out of the depths. And then you'll be able to see what's really going on. So to me, it's about patience. It's about not being afraid to find inspiration in the darker portion of your exploration. And it's also about trusting your intuition and trusting yourself and not expecting it to be like all out in the front with a blaring sign, like, here it is. It takes a bit more patience to work with the moon.
Yeah. And I love that. And I think it's been quite comforting for me to have the moon and also the hermit, which is, just represents the writer's life.
Totally. Yeah. It's like, don't hang out with people. Just go write. Just go do it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And okay, cool. So let's talk about archetypes, because again, we both studied psychology. I've written about Carl Jung. I know you also really interested in Jungian psychology. So how are the archetypes represented between Jungian psychology and the tarot?
I think that there's there's several layers going on. I mean, it's easy to talk about with the major arcana, which again is the focus of the book for this stage, because it not only talks about types that you see, like the Empress is a mother figure, a very maternal figure. You see that in every society. The Emperor is, you know, a paternal figure that's sort of a male energy that's really in charge and can handle everything. And then those are the sorts of archetypal images you see in every society in one way or another. But the other layer of it is that from the beginning of the Major Arcana with the Fool all the way to the world at the end, there is a journey that is happening. And the archetype of a journey is something that's present in most societies. I mean, you see it in the Odyssey, you see it in cave paintings, you see people going out to hunt, trying to solve something and then coming back. And all of these stages of what can happen in the journey are present in the Major Arcana. So you have the little guy at the beginning, the Fool, who's got a backpack on, he sets out, you get to the Magician, he's got a sense of, okay, I'm feeling a sense of mastery. And then he goes through all of these stages leading to the cards that scare people and that everybody wants to throw back in the deck whenever they pull them, like the Tower, or which is, you know, everything falls apart, and like the Devil, which everybody thinks just means the worst possible thing happening. I don't, but we can talk about that if you want. And then also, you know, death, which is sort of an ending, things that have to be, and that can be a literal death or it can be a metaphorical death where a relationship dies, something in a storyline dies, something happens. I mean, death is pretty much as primal an archetype as you can get. And then it comes out the other side with things like the sun and the moon and the star, which is a bit of hope and moving forward into a sort of reckoning with judgment. And then you get to the world, which is sort of like, okay, now we've come full circle, literally like a globe, we've come full circle, and then you start over. And so one thing that I focus on in the book that I think is important is that there's three levels that go through this major arcana journey, which is an archetypal journey. You have your characters in the book will go through their own journey, figure things out, learn things, maybe not learn some other things. And, you know, they will reach a point at the end. The book itself will go through its own evolution, points where the book is working, when the book is not working, when you want to throw the book in the garbage, feeling like this was a stupid idea, I shouldn't have written this book. And then, oh, wait, I figured it out. You get through the Tower part where the book is terrible, and then you have some hope, and then you get to the end, and then you get to the world, and there's your book. But it's also for the writer, because anybody who writes knows that part of the reason that we want to write is that we want to be transformed by the process as well. If it was, we were exactly the same as we were at the beginning, every time we write a book, I mean, that would get pretty boring for me. So those three layers are happening, and you can follow those archetypes through the journey of the major arcana, in the tarot.
Yeah. Wow. It's so interesting. And I mean, this is the truth about writing, isn't it? You can go all these different layers and levels. And like you say, it can be our journey as writers. It can be the journey of the characters. It's just fascinating. There's so much in your book. It really is like jam packed, amazing stuff. But I am interested because, of course, you also do readings for other people. You do readings for other writers. So,
I do.
But if people want to do their own reading with your book, like how would they do that? Or how do you do it for other people?
Well, I think the way I started was basically that, like you, I was getting the same cards all the time for myself. Like I was sort of pulling, I would go through phases and it does change, but I mean, they kind of know, I would use a different deck. I would change. It's like, nope, you're still getting the, whatever it was, you know, you're still getting the Hangman right now. Like you're in limbo, too bad for you. And so I said, well, there's cards I'm just never drawing. So I want to learn. So I decided I was going to do 100 readings one summer. And I just told anybody, I'm doing it by donation. I really just want to build more of a relationship with these other cards that I never pull. And then I ended up doing one of those readings for someone who was working on a book. And they said, I don't really need a reading for me. I feel okay about me, but I'm really getting stuck on this book. So what we did was we looked at what was not working with the book. Where was the stuck point with the book? And then you start to ask questions and then pull a card and then look at the card. And like we discussed earlier, your subconscious will start to fill in answers. So you can ask questions. And it's best if they are who, what, when, where, why kind of questions. Why is really good. How is pretty good. What's missing is good. You don't want to say, is this book good? Yes or no. That's really not going to work very well with the tarot. They have to be a little bit more like prompts where you would want to do some journaling after you do it. But I do put a couple of spreads that are examples of ones I've created, especially for writers, in the book. One is which is like working with dialogue. So if somebody's having a conversation, you can pull a card for each character, and then you can pull another card underneath each character to say, what are they really trying to talk about here? Because no one ever talks about what they actually are talking about in a book, or they shouldn't, because otherwise you get things like, oh, George, we must run forth before the explosion happens because it will kill us all. And this is not expository dialogue at all. You know, it's just, you don't want that. So there has to be something going on underneath. So picking something for your surface level and then picking for things underneath is really helpful. Another thing that's helpful is if you get into this situation, I don't know if anyone else has this happen, it happens to me all the time, where my character is in location A, I need to get them to location B, and they don't seem to want to go to location B. It just feels unnatural, or it's like, oh, I got to get them there, but it feels really far, you know? And what you can do is, I used to live in Maine for a while at one point. And one thing that they like to say is like, oh, you can't get there from here, you know, because the roads are constructed in such a way that it's very difficult to get to a place that looks very close by. So I had a spread in my head that I called the you can't get there from here. So you pick a card for where the character is now, you pick a card for where they're trying to go, and then you pick another one for in between that, and then start saying, oh, that the people in there are, you know, there are cards, you don't have to know what the tarot means. I would hate people listening to feel like they have to go buy a bunch of tarot books and study it and learn it. It's not like learning a foreign language where you can't interact with it if you don't know what the words actually mean. Because they're pictures, you can look at the picture, and it's more important that you decide what that picture looks like to you. So if you see something like the Five of Wands, and there's a bunch of people trying to poke each other with long sticks, and you say, oh, it looks like they're in a fight. It's not going well, huh? Maybe if she got in a fight with somebody, then she'd want to leave and then she could go to this other location. So it's more important that your unconscious kicks in when you're looking at the cards so that your associations and your understanding of your story is what allows it to mean more and to give you some aha moments.
I love that. I love the idea of the two levels of the dialogue and then what's actually going on underneath. That's a really good tip. I love that. I'm going to try that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. So let's talk about the decks because, you know, as you're in art history and I, you know, I love visual images and have looked at a lot of this stuff. And the interesting thing is there's not one tarot deck that everybody uses. So there might be one card called the moon as such, but if you buy a, you know, Native American deck versus the, you know, the Rider-Waite, as we've mentioned, is the kind of maybe the best known, but we've also got the Thoth deck in our house, which my husband likes. And, I know you have other ones. So tell us a bit about like the deck or decks you prefer. And also, does it matter? I mean, you know, and why are the images so different?
Well, I think they're different. Well, there's a couple of things in there. So I don't think it, first of all, I will say it does not matter what deck you get as long as you like it. So if you respond to the imagery and the imagery feels really exciting or rewarding, or it connects to the kind of thing you're trying to work on, then I think it's completely fine. I don't think there's no one deck to rule them all. That's just, I don't think that exists, especially now when there's new decks coming out all the time. The Rider-Waite-Smith is sort of become one syntax. So there are a lot of decks that will take the illustrations that Pamela Smith originally did. And that was one of the first, I think that was the first deck to have illustrations, not just for the major arcana, but for the minor arcana. In many decks before that, it used to just look like playing cards where you'd have, you know, symbols that were the number of symbols for that. Like there would be five wands in a picture and that was it. There would be no scene. So she's the one who came up with all of the scenes, and the scenes have fairly consistent things that happen. So you'll see a lot of decks that have very different styles of art. And it's fun if you're a big nerd like me, where you're like, oh, I can't, oh, that's so clever how they place that a little differently than this. But it's sort of the same. There's, you know, there's always going to be a lobster with the moon in the Rider-Waite-Smith convention. The Thoth is a completely different sort of syntax. It's like that one is a different language. So if you're really into that, that is its own kind of system, if that makes sense to you. So for somebody who's looking to build a relationship with the tarot, it's kind of interesting to pay attention to which one that is. You don't have to get an actual Rider-Waite-Smith deck if you don't respond to the imagery. Some people love it. Some people are just like, well, I'm not into it. But there are so many out there that it's, I mean, there's a deck for you. I'm somewhere. There is a deck. There are so many. And a really good place to start, I find, is there is a site called, I never know how to pronounce it, eclectic.net. And you can look up tarot decks. And they, for most decks that have been published, with the exception of some independents that are on Kickstarter and so on and not yet indexed, but they will have pictures of most of the deck. And I think that one thing to guard against when you're buying a deck is that sometimes you'll see a picture of a deck and there's like a picture on the cover of the box. And then you may see like one or two others and think you're really into it. And then you get it. And those three are the ones that you love. And then the rest of the deck leaves you flat. It's like when the single on the album is amazing. And then the rest of the album, you're not into it. That can happen with tarot. But so the more you can see as many cards in the deck as possible before purchasing, or even better, if you can go to a shop and see them, then that will help. Often if you buy things off Etsy or an independent site or like Little Red Tarot in Europe is a great source. Those places will have pictures of lots of the cards. So you can make sure that this is really something you're responding to. I had a giant card catalog file filled with decks before we left the US in the fall. I had to cut it down. So I ended up really culling down to, I mean, hilariously, it was culling down to like 50 decks. Like it was not,
wow. Okay.
It was not culling down to two. There's no way I was going to get that. There was somewhere I was like, oh, this is cool. But, you know, I gave them to friends or who were interested, but yeah, I still have, you know, probably 40 or 50 decks.
Whoa. But is there one that you like, what did you write the book on, for example, or did you just kind of use them all?
I tended to use groups because I think that I didn't want to be writing from just one deck because I felt like I would be really leaning on that card's imagery. And I wanted someone reading the book to be able to use the deck that they loved and not to be kind of wedded to it. And I played with using imagery from cards in the book, but then I was like, no, I don't want to have a particular deck that people feel they have to respond to. And I have different decks. There is, if you go on Pinterest, and you, this is a great place to find tarot spreads. If you search for a question that you have and say tarot spread, then they will appear. There's one that's called a deck interview, which is kind of fun. So when you get a deck, you can interview your deck, which is really fun. Because if you go down the rabbit hole like I did, if you're into it, you will end up, just get a cabinet and you're going to have all your decks in there and it's going to be fine. But there are different decks that have very different imagery. Like I have one called the Bohemian Gothic that's hilarious. And it's like old fashioned, crazy Dracula, you know, kind of stuff. Like I'm not going to use that to write a romance scene necessarily, you know, or if you're writing a romance novel, you may not want that deck. So you may have, you know, but if you're writing like an adventure kind of suspense plot, you're probably not going to use like the Cat Tarot, of which there are many. Mm-hmm. So I think that you can have different decks that work for different situations. And one of the things in this deck interview spread is you can say, what are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? You pull cards for this. And then it says, what should we work on together? So you could look at, maybe this deck is really into dialogue, or maybe this deck is really into character development, or it's really into crime novels. And maybe you have another deck that's really, really into romance novels. And maybe you have another one that's really into literary fiction. It's tough to say. But I like the idea that they all have their own personalities and they're really into different kinds of subjects, just like we are. And that the art will activate different parts of your brain that, you know, will work well for that. I mean, that said, all that really matters is that you like it.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. So, you know, when I was reading your stuff, I was like, oh, I should look at some other decks. And then I fell like into the rabbit hole, as you said.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, I'm backing away now.
Because yeah, you got to back away.
It's so cool, but it's also like very intimidating. So I'm back to my Rider Waite. But it is, it's definitely beautiful as well. I think this is really important, like to stress that this is, you know, writing prompts can so often be written. Writing prompts are written, yep. Whereas this is almost a writing prompt from something visual. When I'm a visual writer, like I'm often looking at visual stuff to prompt my writing. So if people listening are in that phase, then that really works.
Definitely. Mm. I mean, I think it's just, yeah, I think it's helpful to have different kinds of prompts. You can even just say, I feel like writing something, pull a card and just see like, okay, well, look at this picture and say, okay, what would a circumstance be surrounding this scene? And just start writing that and see what happens.
Mm. Cool. So I wanted to ask about your podcast because you have the Secret Library podcast, which is amazing. And you interview some like seriously famous writers, a lot of literary fiction, a lot of kind of prize winners and really interesting guests. So I definitely urge people to check out the Secret Library podcast. But I wonder, because you have interviewed so many super successful authors, are there any commonalities that you see in those writers that you've kind of learned over the years?
I think so. I mean, there are some. I've thought about this a lot, but one of the things I've noticed is that just in speaking to them, there isn't this point where you're a prize winner or you've won an award for your book or something. And then writing suddenly becomes this really easy process where there's no doubts or fears or concerns, or you never get stuck. I think what I've learned from talking to them is that they're not superhuman. It's kind of like when you get to the age when your parents were, when you were a certain age and frustrated with them and you thought, you're an adult, you're supposed to understand everything. And then you get to this age, you're like, oh no, they didn't know. They had no idea what was going on. Yeah. It feels a little bit like that, which is not to say that these writers don't know what's going on. It's just that I think that for many years, I thought when I was trying to write books that when I got really stuck and didn't know what to do, that was an indication of my lack of skill, or that it was an indication that I didn't know what I was doing. And in talking to so many authors who hit that point and yet work through it and continue, that point of feeling like, I don't know what I'm doing right now is not an indication of failure. It's just part of the process. And I think author after author after author that I've talked to has had that experience. And even the ones who are really big and have, you know, hit it really big, have often written like four or five books that they tried to sell. And, you know, nothing was happening. There was nothing keeping them going. I mean, I think of Donald Ryan, who is a fiction writer, and he just tried and tried and tried and tried and tried. And he said, the only reason I kept going was because my wife just said, you know what, it's good and you should keep going. And then as soon as he published, he was shortlisted for a prize. Mm. But it took years, and he could have given up at any moment if there hadn't been somebody saying, no, this is worth it, what you're doing. Mm. So I think that seems to be a consistent theme, is that there was some force that convinced them that how terrible it can feel at certain points was not an indication of, you know, that they shouldn't be writing, or that writing wasn't for them.
Mm. That's interesting you picked that one, because you're also writing a novel right now, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah. So do you think that's the thing that you personally are taking in, or what else are you taking into your writing process from what you've learned?
It's probably the one that's with me today, because today I have a library that I go to. I'm a member of a library here in Berlin, which I love, and it is like my zone. And I was running a little bit late this morning. It's a very popular library. You have to be a member, but I got there and there were no desks, and it completely threw me off my game, and I wrote nothing this morning. Mm. So I think, having heard this from all of these writers, I'm like, oh, good, this is not an indicator that the book is not going to get finished. It's just a hiccup in the routine and I have to just go back tomorrow and it'll be fine. Mm-hmm. But I think other things with them is just that that one is the one that is the most consistent. And not even today, and not even when I was really hardcore working in the book, I was always present with that and always with clients. But I think the other thing too is that there are points when you have to let go of control of the book in ways that are sometimes uncomfortable. I can think of several people. One in particular, the most dramatic by far, was Patricia Park, who was working on a book called Ray Jane. And it was a Korean retelling of Jane Eyre. And Jane Eyre was sort of, she was working in her uncle's shop in New York, in sort of one of the boroughs. And she hit this point where it's like, oh, this book is not working. I can't believe it. And she got a Fulbright to go to South America and kind of spend a lot of time researching the Korean community in South America, which is quite large, in Argentina. Mm-hmm. And she got into there and then she was really in it and she was starting to develop something. And then she realized that the character that she was developing was actually a B character in her original book that she had decided was not working. So it's like, you just never know what journey. I mean, not everybody's probably going to get a Fulbright and go to South America and research and realize that it's still the same book. But she thought she had a whole new book and it was still the same book. Mm. And the other thing too, I think the other one that really stands out is I have had every single person who has mentioned the length of time it has taken them to write a book has been irritated at how long it took. And none of them have said, God, I really wish it had taken a little bit longer. It really, this book could have taken me another 6 months. That would have been great. But no, it just happened so fast. No, nobody ever says that. It's always like there's something about it that was inefficient or difficult, but also that they gained insight that they needed to have through the process of it being inefficient and difficult, and that they were grateful for the insight, but they just wish it hadn't taken quite so long.
Interesting. That is super interesting. So I also want to ask you about Berlin, because you mentioned the library there. Yes. And you've been there a few months now, I guess. 6 months?
Yeah, we've been four. We've been here four for months. Four.
Yeah. So obviously you're American. And so I guess what has Berlin done for you in terms of your life and your, you know, what has it changed up about your life? And, you know, how does, I guess, changing place can really help you change your state as well?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think we had been thinking about this for a few years. We lived in Los Angeles for many years. I was there for 12. My husband was there for 20. And we were at a point where we just didn't feel like Los Angeles. It was time to break up with Los Angeles, basically, mm-hmm. was what it was. And part of that is how expensive that city has gotten. I want to be writing. I don't want to be sitting in the car, which is what you have to do a lot there. There were just a lot of things that we just felt like it wasn't suiting what we wanted. And so we got rid of like 80% of our stuff. We moved here. We went from an 1800 square foot, three bedroom place with two bathrooms to a 440 square foot apartment with one bathroom in which we have three cats and a dog. It's a very, very interesting dynamic. This is a temporary flat. We will be in something larger before long, but I think we just wanted to cut away all of the distractions and all of the things that were keeping us from doing creative work. My husband's an artist. He's an illustrator, animator, designer, and then I'm writing. And I just felt that there were so many life admin kind of, it just takes forever to get anywhere in LA. There was just a lot. And it was just all of those things were taking away from the writing. And also a majority of the book I'm writing right now is set in Berlin. So it turns out it's quite difficult to write a book that's set in Berlin when you're in Los Angeles, because they are not very similar. So I think some of it is, you know, being in the location of the place that I'm writing about is a huge support. And I think that just the European sensibility was one that we have always been interested in and supported. Like, we just couldn't do the 10 days off a year anymore in America. The, like, you know, you have to make $150,000 to $200,000 to even consider having significant savings, that, like, just to pay for your life and all of those things. We're like, that's just not sustainable. And it's not sustainable doing creative work unless you want to work 80 hours a week when you put your creative work and your day job together. So we just wanted to pull the plug on all of that, which has been wonderful. And to be somewhere where kind of just the prevailing value system is not that people should be ground into dust by their work lives. So I'm feeling extremely liberated by that. I'm feeling very grateful to be here. I'm very grateful not to have a car anymore.
It's a big thing, isn't it? Like people
it's amazing.
You can just walk places.
Yeah, you walk. We have bikes, you know, we bike or we take the
tube,
you know, the public transit, which is here and functional, you know, things like that. I think, but the other thing about that, that's really good for a writer is I sit on the train on the way to the library every day that I go to the library and I see a new character. I see someone, I get to watch them and see what they're doing. What are they wearing? How are they fidgeting? That can go straight in the book. If I'm sitting in a car on a freeway in LA, I don't get that interaction. I don't get to hear their voice if they're talking to their kid or they're talking to their friend. All of those details go right in a city like Berlin or, you know, London is the same. There are many cities that have good public transit and everybody's out on it. New York is the same. We were not built for New York. You really have to want that one. So being here and being able to be a part of that. And the other thing too is like, you know, as an American, things are different here. They look different. The sidewalks look different. And I love that. So I enjoy gobbling all of that detail up.
Yeah, fantastic. And yeah, I lived in New Zealand and Australia. I was away 11 years and I just missed, you know, I'm a European, you know, I feel like that. And I missed so many things about Europe. So I'm really excited about your book when it eventually makes it out there, your Berlin book.
Yes.
And also you've got another podcast coming, haven't you, if people are interested?
I do. Yeah, I have a really good friend who's also an American, and she took the leap from Boulder, Colorado. She and her family felt like, oh, they need a change. She and her husband and her son. And there's been a tech boom in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And she's worked in that field for ages. So they went to Dublin and they've been there for 2 years now. And so we decided, based on so many conversations that we would have with people, that like, oh, that's amazing that you've moved to, I could never do that. That's really amazing what you've done. And we said, well, actually, it's just a series. We've both been project managers. So we're like, well, it's just a series of practical steps that you can follow. If you know what they are, it's really not that bad. So we wanted to do a series of episodes of just short, kind of actionable, this is how we've done these things. And that is the GTFO podcast that will be coming.
What does that stand for?
It stands for get the feck out. We're going with the Irish feck rather than the other.
Yes, fantastic.
So that we don't get kicked off of iTunes.
That is a good idea. And this is a clean show. And that word is clean. You know.
Yes, I know.
That's fantastic. So where can people find you and everything you do online?
They can find me at carolinedonahue.com, and then they can find the show at the Secret Library, secretlibrarypodcast.com. And there's links to everything. I'm on Instagram and Twitter and everything, but all of those are on both of those sites.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Caroline. That was great.
Thank you so much. It was such a treat talking to you as always.
So I hope you enjoyed this interview with Caroline today and that you got some ideas for your own creativity and writing practices. Now, next week, I'm talking about writing heroes and writing villains with Sasha Black. So happy writing and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.